the rather brilliant Paul Hayes. He's written a book about his life, Sonic Assassin. Started off with knowing Lemmy, believe it or not, ended up going through with Hawkwind, hijinks, fast times, and some teaching larks as well. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, if I'm turning him away from the cricket. Paul Hayes himself. Paul, good morning, good afternoon to you.
Hi there. Speaking to you.
Good to have you. Well, how's the cricket going, Paul? Ladies and gentlemen, I phoned Paul before going on air, and I said, "You're right." He said, "Yeah, I'm just watching the cricket." So, how are we doing? What's the score at the moment, Paul?
Well, we're 108 for two. We're still 389 behind them.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. It's going to be a slow burner then. Do you think?
I think so. Yeah. We're headed for a draw, I think.
Right then, away from the cricket commentary, and thanks very much for that. Paul, in your excellent book, which I'm holding on my desk now, you describe this sort of as music as something you kind of fell into.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of music. I had been since I was quite young. Came from a bit of a musical family, but I never intended to do anything besides playing in a local band.
So how did it sort of come about that you ended up auditioning? Did you audition for Hawkwind at the same, or you listened to the same bands at the same time as Lemmy? How did that all happen? And how did you come across the young Kilminster?
Well, the young Kilminster and I both went for an audition with a band called Sam Capel back in 69. I went because a guy that knew me well said, "Oh, you've got to go and audition for this." I was for keyboards, Lemmy was for rhythm guitar. I got offered the job, but didn't take it because it meant buying a Hammond organ, which was well beyond my capabilities, financially. Right. And Lemmy never got offered the job.
So how did it then, and what was it like hanging out with the young Lemmy? Was he, because did he mellow much over the years?
Well, I didn't really know him then. We sort of said hi and then played. But I got to know him better through the years. And the last time I saw him is when I went to see him in a French hotel, because I lived in France then, and I wanted to get ticket for me and my son to go and see his show. We had a chat in his hotel, and he gave my son 10 tickets so he could take all his mates and be the hero.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant thing. Brilliant news indeed. Tell me a little bit about then how the Hawkwind connection came in, because it's late 60s. You've just got off back from the Isle of Wight Festival. What happened?
Well, I qualified to be a teacher, and I started teaching in a boarding school for young maladjusted boys, as we used to call them. And I also was playing in a local band called ARC. And Dave Brock and Bob Calvert both lived around where we lived. And I, in fact, met them because our guitarist, Chris, him and his then wife, they ran a thing called Baron Market, which was sort of the head shop of Barnstable.
Right, the head shop of Barnstable. That's a claim to fame, isn't it? The head shop of Barnstable.
All the hippies used to hang out there, and that's where Chris met Dave Brock, and I met Dave Brock. And he asked Ark, because we were Barnstable's band, you know, Barnstable's alternative freak band.
Right.
He asked us to support Hawkwind on a tour. I think that was in 75. Then at Stonehenge Festival, Nick Turner and Bob Calvert joined ARC as a sort of horn section. And then some of Hawkwind didn't turn up, and so ARC members replaced them when Hawkwind played. Then one day out of the blue, Dave asked me and Harvey, the bass player, and Martin, the drummer of ARC, to meet him in a hotel in Barnstable.
Barnstable's finest hotel, I would think.
Yeah. Bob Calvert was already there playing the local gentleman like he used to. And the idea was that we would do a concert under the name Sonic Assassins Dave and Bob of Hawkwind and us three from ARC, and do it on Christmas Eve and record it as well. We had a couple of rehearsals and did the show, which became a bit of a cult album. And then about 3 months later, my wife got a phone call from Dave saying that would Paul like to tour the States with Hawkwind? And my wife phoned me up, and I hesitated because I thought it would mean losing my job, which it did. But my wife said, you've got to do it, she'll always regret it. So I did it.
I was going to say, I mean, it's one of those moments. If you are, I mean, obviously you love doing what you're teaching, but if you get the opportunity to go play and go tour with something like Hawkwind, I mean, you're not going to say, ooh, give me a second. What was it like then? You know, going, because didn't you go over to the States with the Hawkwind as well?
Yeah, we did quite a long tour. It was difficult at first because I didn't have any chance except for one very short rehearsal to rehearse with the band. They were playing a lot of new numbers I didn't know, and to make it worse, they just bought this very expensive, one of the first polyphonic synthesizers.
Right.
Which only had four memories. And for a 90-minute show, you need a lot more than four sounds. And trying to get the sound sorted was a big problem. The second problem was Simon House, who had been playing keyboards, when he left to join the David Bowie band, he took the keyboard effects pedals with him.
Sorry, yes, right.
Which left me with no effects. And despite me asking Dave, the band leader, you know, to get me some effect pedals, it never happened.
Didn't that kind of make playing with Hawkwind a bit of a problem?
It was not easy. I mean,
Sorry, that's just understatement of the week so far.
Yeah, it was difficult, and but I just thought, I'm going to get on with it. I'm going to play as well as I can. I'm going to enjoy myself, which I did.
And I mean, enjoying yourself with Hawkwind, then there might have been things backstage that were stronger than a cup of mint tea, methinks.
Rather, yeah. And, you know, I got to the point where I wasn't able to eat. A lady, when we were in California for the last 2 weeks, luckily this very nice lady said she was going to look after me, and she made sure that at least I had some carrot juice every lunchtime. That's the sort of state I got to.
Right, fair enough. I think we're only at sort of between lunch and tea time around here at the moment in Spain. So I think we'll leave it at that with that one. You got to meet some pretty much your heroes, basically. I mean, everybody from Van Halen through to Ian during the Blockheads.
Yeah, and of course the top one was having a meal with David Bowie.
Oh, of course. So tell me a little bit about, I mean, presumably you were off the carrot juice at that point.
It was a nice Mexican dinner, and I knew it was happening, so I'd been a bit more sensible that day.
Right.
And because David Bowie took us out to apologise for pinching Simon House, who had been the keyboard player, because I was the replacement, it was decided I should sit opposite David Bowie and be introduced as a new keyboard player. And we had a few things in common because we're from the same part of London. I had seen him before when he ran his folk club in Beckenham.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which I went to a couple of times. And I also discovered from chatting that when I went back to London as a student, I was living three doors down the road from David Bowie's mum.
So when you what year was this, and what stage of Bowie-ness? Were we in Thin White Duke stage? He'd obviously wasn't Aladdin stage, or was it 70? What year was this be about? Was it about 75?
78.
Oh, 78, okay.
And he was just about to set off on the world touring the album Heroes.
Ah, right. Must have been. So what was it? I mean, was, you obviously kind of got on with him. I mean, didn't were you a little bit overawed? Did you have to watch? You didn't spill sort of taco juice on your shoes? I mean, how was it?
I think he was shyer than I am.
Right.
He came across as very shy. He had two bodyguards with him that were twice his size, each of them. And he was just very pleasant.
And did you get the question is, did you get the pedals back, by the way, at this point?
No. No, there were no pedals right to the end of the tour.
Right then, so... You managed to make it by hook, crook and carrot juice to the end of the US tour. Did you want to continue or did you just want to go back to your teaching job after doing that with Hawkwind?
Well, at the end of the tour, with Simon King, neither of us wanted to rush home, so we kept one of the hired cars and went down the Californian coast, caught up with the Bowie band. We didn't re-meet David, but we hung out with the band.
Right.
And set off back for the UK about 2 weeks later. When I got home, I was a bit shocked because my two young children, who were 6 and 2.5, well, definitely the 2.5 one, was looking at me as if to say, who's that? And my wife just said it took me 3 months to get back to normal.
So
there was a lot of me that was saying, do I really want to do this, you know? And if I'd have stayed, there was talk of an Asian tour, Australia, back in the studio to record another album. So I was sort of humming and hawing. And my wife said, let's move to France, because we'd always talked about doing that. And I said, well, we'll just see what happens. Then one day, the polyphonic keyboard, which had been delivered to my house, was collected by some of the crew with no explanation. I knew that things between the band and management and the record company was very dodgy at that time. I thought, you know, they're going to forget about new people, try and keep with the old people, try and sort out their management problems. And I thought, I don't want to take the risk, I don't want to be involved. And we moved to France.
You may have moved to France and you sort of set up the self-sufficient lifestyle at the end of the 70s, but the music still came with you. You got involved with, was it Legend, the local band?
Yeah, we had a band called Legend, we had another band called Exit, another one called Exiles, and because I needed to make money from music, I started playing with a rock band that knew that to make money, you had to play village festivals, which all villages have in France, and they usually have a band for 3 days. You play a half-hour old-fashioned music bit, and then you play for 4 hours from 10 till 2. And I was getting per gig the same as I was getting per week when I was playing with Hawkwind.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But you just had to play hits. I mean, they didn't have to be all the bad poppy hits. I mean, we finished all our sets with Smoke on the Water.
Well, that'd do. That would do, absolutely.
But it was good fun. I did that for about 3 years. And then I met up with Topper Hedden of The Clash.
Was he just passing through buying a baguette? I mean, where in France were you, by the way?
This was about 40 miles northeast of Avignon.
Okay.
Just where the Out foothills started, a town called Nyons. And a Scottish guy there had a nightclub, but he also had a farm where bands could come and stay and rehearse in the club during the week. And in return, they'd play an hour set every Friday and Saturday night at about 1 a.m.
Ah.
And a band called Blackfoot Sioux, I'd seen there the year before. And then Topper Hedden, who'd been kicked out the Clash, had formed a new band, and they were rehearsing there. And we met up, Topper and, what's his name? the guitarist who played with Joe Cocker at Woodstock. Henry McCulloch, yeah. That's right, who sadly died about 18 months ago. He was in the band. Topper and Henry came to our local recording studio to record on a couple of tracks that I was doing as demos for an album. Then he asked me to join them to play in the club. And that was great fun. I mean, Topper was amazing because he appeared out of his room into the front courtyard and bounced off every wall trying to come across the courtyard to talk to us. We had to sit him on his drum stool because he could hardly walk, but he didn't miss a beat. You know, he was a great drummer.
Obviously, Le Clash had a pretty sort of huge following in France and everywhere, didn't they? But they were massive in Europe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were. And playing with him, that was another good notch on my bat, so to speak, because I was quite well known in the area, but my standing went up about 3 miles because I'd played with Topper.
Brilliant. When did you decide to wave goodbye to France and go back to the UK and revitalise your, you know, getting in touch with old friends such as Hawkwind?
Well, yeah, but things weren't going too well with my wife, and we had a business that suffered a bit. So I said, we got to move back to England. I got myself work straight away, doing the same sort of work. And if you stay in that sort of work any length of time and you're good at it, and you have to be good at it to stay in it, you get promotion. And I was very quickly a deputy head and then a head. I ended up being the head of 3 different boarding schools for these boys with emotional behavioural difficulties. And I kept doing music, again, to keep myself sane, really. That was the thing I did to relax. I ended up playing with a guy who was in probably the first ever rap band, who were called the Last Poets. We went to see Public Enemy, and they got him up on stage and presented him as the godfather of rap. He was a very interesting guy. Also died last year of cancer in poverty in Atlanta. But we worked well together, and that was very interesting. And then one day, out of the blue, I had a phone call from Dave Brock of Hawkwind. He'd bumped into some of my music that was on a site on the internet, said he liked it, did I have a band, and would I like to come on tour supporting Hawkwind? I didn't have a band. I'd done all the recording myself, and so I said, yes, I've got a band, yeah, no problem.
Like you do.
Like you do, yeah, you have to bluff a bit in this business. But then I put a band together, which included the drummer who had drummed with Ronnie Sides when he did his world tour after winning the Mercury Music Prize, a guy who was married to John Paul Jones's daughter.
Okay. The useful connection to have, I think.
Yeah, another useful connection. But after a couple of rehearsals, we went to the pub, as we used to, and the two musicians that I was using said, look, we want 50 quid a rehearsal and 100 quid a gig each.
Blimey.
Now, Dave Brock said, you know, as support band, we'd only be getting 100 quid for the band per gig. So I couldn't afford to be financing this sort of stuff. So I found a solution. A young, brilliant French guitarist who's done the music for adverts for companies like Citroen. He's been very successful in the following years. I phoned him and said, would he be interested in doing it? He said he'd do it for the crack, as long as I paid his fare and his keep. And he came over. I programmed the drums and the bass in one of my keyboards, plus a few other bits of keyboard, and played keyboard live and sang. And we did it as two. And I know that Hawkins' manager, Chris, when we arrived for the first gig, said, well, where are the rest of you? And I said, that's us. But don't worry, we make an awful lot of noise.
Excellent. Why did you decide then that it was to put this all down in this great book that I'm holding in my hand, Sonic Assassin Alive? And by the way, I do like the cover. You're looking very sort of Dirty Harry on the front cover there.
Well, that was me 10 years ago. I've cleaned up my act a bit since then, right, due to health reasons. But I wrote the book because I was feeling a bit bad health-wise. In fact, I nearly died in 2017, saved by a helicopter being in the vicinity to fly me 100 miles to the nearest hospital to cope with what my problem was. So I was spending a lot of time indoors, and I thought, I've got to write a book. Everybody used to say I'd had such an interest in life. People who didn't know me would look at me and say, you're lying. This can't possibly be true. So I thought, yeah, I'll write it. And I'm now writing a second book just about the kids I used to work with. That is something that I'm still...
I was going to say, who had the most interesting behaviour? Sort of backstage Hawkwind in the 70s in the States, or some of the kids that you work with?
Some of the kids I've worked with some real crackers. And I'm still in touch with a lot of them. They find me on Facebook and send me these lovely messages saying how they managed to survive. They've got a wife and kids, they've got a job. And it was all down to me, which makes me cry, quite frankly.
Well, you know, you can talk about the music, but that perhaps, my man, is the most important thing of all. The book is called Sonic Assassin, A Life in a Life. It's out now in paperback. It's by Paul Hayes. Paul Holes. Paul, if people want to find you, is there social media? Is there a website? Where can they get hold of you?
Best thing is to find me on Facebook, where... under my name, Paul Hales. There's quite a lot of Paul Hales, but I'm top of the list, usually. And I've also got a music page on Facebook as well. So that's the easiest place to find me.
Paul, we'll let you get back to the critic. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. The book is called Sonic Assassin, A Life. It's by Paul Hales. Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
Been a pleasure, Giles.